Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. All of it brought to you by Tripping.com. With Tripping.com, one search lets you filter, compare, and sort over 10 million available properties for rental, and you can save an average of 18% per night. Much more on Tripping.com a little bit later in the podcast. Jim, let's start with the good martini. And once again, excellent work on your part to dig into one of the key aspects of the 2018 midterms. It was either last week or the week before. You took a look at all the districts currently represented by Republicans who are not running for re-election this year. And we discovered that, by and large, the vast majority of them should be pretty safe holds for the Republicans, barring a massive blue wave. You've recently looked at the governorships now, and once again, we're looking at likely some pretty good news come November. Here's what you write. Once again, the 10 most popular governors in America are all Republicans. Congratulations to Charlie Baker of Massachusetts, Larry Hogan of Maryland, Kay Ivey of Alabama, Phil Scott of Vermont, Matt Mead of Wyoming, Brian Sandoval of Nevada, Gary Herbert of Utah, Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas, Greg Abbott of Texas, and Dennis Daugaard of South Dakota. Baker, Hogan, Ivey, Scott, Hutchinson, and Abbott are up for re-election this year, and right now the outlook is sunny and bright for all of them. And this is my favorite part, Jim, that you write. I would note that none of the above names are really celebrity governors or well-known outside their states. They're workhorses, not show horses, that are focused on, well, governing. What a concept. So, Jim, that's not to say that there won't be challenging races, even with some of these folks who are popular governors in blue states, but the fact that we've got a pretty good foothold on approval in some of these battleground states is a great sign.
Yeah, Greg, the one number on there that kind of unnerved me a little bit was Scott Walker, one of our all-time favorites up in Wisconsin. 43% approval, 50% disapproval. Now, I know you've heard Democrats are really sure they're going to get Scott Walker this year for about the past, you know, at least three of the last four election cycles. Scott Walker always does tend to overperform. Wisconsin Democrats do tend to trip over their shoelaces. It's like Lucy in the football. So on the one hand, he's probably doing a little better than expected. But, you know, they lost that special election for the state Senate out there. And you know, Scott Walker had said, we can't assume that people know that jobs are being created and that we are reducing spending and things like that. So, you know, there is some reason to worry out there. Bruce Rauner in Illinois, it's not looking good. It was always tough to elect a governor, a Republican governor in Illinois, 31% approval, 55% disapproval. I think he'll probably run much closer than that in the election. And he definitely has begun his efforts. But let's no fooling about that. That's going to be difficult. Now, it is worth noting that amongst those who are not particularly popular, most of them are not up for re-election. Paul LePage of Maine, Rick Snyder of Michigan, Chris Christie is on the list, even though he technically left office earlier this year. Dan Malloy, the scourge of Connecticut, who called National Review a Tea Party rag. He's just phenomenally unpopular and not seeking another term. And he deserves it, Greg. You suffered, Dan Malloy. You got that coming to you. Also, Sam Brownback, leaving the state with not a great deal of popularity, but he's about to become U.S. Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom. So, you know, as 2018 dawns for Republican governors, a lot of good news and, you know, only a couple spots to worry about. So, all in all, in this area, it's not bad. One other thing worth noting, Rick Scott is term limited, will not be running for re-election as governor of Florida, but he periodically sounds like or acts like he's interested in running for Senate against Bill Nelson, who would otherwise be very difficult to beat. Florida is a very big, expensive state, and Nelson manages to hang on despite having he's perceived as moderate, much more moderate than he actually is. Rick Scott probably would go toe-to-toe with him. It'd instantly make this a really dramatic race. Rick Scott's beginning the final year of being governor with a 58% approval rating and just 31% disapproving. So for a guy who won two very close races, he is wrapping up his gubernatorial years with high approval, and that can only be good news for Republicans heading forward.
Jim, if a Democrat were to replace Bruce Rauner in Illinois, how would we know?
You know, it's worth noting, we had recently declared him at National Review the worst Republican governor in the country. Now, again, some of that's because Christie's leaving, right? So, you know, some of this is, you know, you move up in the rankings no matter what. But, you know, Jeb Bush wrote a big op-ed on our pages defending him for expanding school choice. I suppose you'd say he'd be an improvement. And I'll admit, you know, look, you got a heavily Democratic state legislature. You're going to have a tough time getting your reforms through. Having said that, yeah, it's probably likely that a lot of conservatives, if Roner were to be defeated, would be not exactly crying in their beer.
Well, they don't have to cry yet. They can go vote for Jeannie Ives in the primary. I don't know if she has a chance, but she'd be a massive upgrade. And Rauner's not going to win anyway. So, all right, on to the bad martini now, Jim. Let's move on to fiscal news. We've had a lot of good economic news. Now we've got some not-so-great economic news. This is from the Wall Street Journal. For decades, the U.S. government could issue as much debt as it needed to finance deficits without worrying about how it affected financial markets or the economy. That might be changing. Treasury yields are rising, some investors think in part because the supply of government bonds hitting financial markets is on the rise as budget deficits rise as a result of the Trump administration's recent $1.5 trillion tax cut. The Treasury said Wednesday that the size of its regular auctions of bills, notes, and bonds were going up in the coming months. And so we're talking basically back in the neighborhood of trillion-dollar deficits again, potentially $955 billion in the fiscal year that ends September 30th, up substantially from $519 billion the previous fiscal year. So, Jim, there are a number of factors here. It certainly looks like it's not just the tax cuts, but the tax cuts are a policy that certainly affect other things. And regardless of how you get to trillion-dollar deficits, that's never a good thing, and it's going to be hard for growth to make up for that.
Yeah, look, you know, $519 billion last year, not good, but we can, you know, not as bad as the worst of the recession years. You know, the projection to get close to a trillion this year and then a trillion the next two fiscal years after that. Look, these are projections. Theoretically, they could be wrong, but I don't think they're going to be off by hundreds of billions of dollars. This is bad. This is, you know, we did not like this back when we were marching with the Tea Party and protesting all that. Yes, you can probably say economic growth is going to increase tax revenues some. But in the end, you know, there's no serious discussion of entitlement reform under the Trump administration. There's no serious obviously, we're not going to cut defense spending. We're probably, in fact, going to increase that. These deficits are only going to get worse. And the argument that Republicans and conservatives are somewhat hypocritical because they were really upset about deficits under Obama and are, if you know, kind of looking at the floor, looking at their shoes, shuffling uncomfortably as there's talk of trillion-dollar deficits under Trump, I think there's some legitimacy to that. We will see if this shakes out. If Republicans do start talking about more serious spending cuts in the months to come, my guess is in a midterm year they will not. And my guess is we will see, if not a trillion-dollar deficit, you know, something getting closer to that. And, you know, for our long-term fiscal health, that is just not good. Not good, as the president would tweet.
Jim, you and I have addressed this a couple of times, and I think you have crystallized it better than anyone else I've seen. And that's that the American people have asked to weigh in on this before, whether it's with Social Security reform. George W. Bush tried that. Entitlement reform in general. Spending cuts, which everybody loves until a program they like gets put on the chopping block. The American people like the idea in general, at least a lot of them. But when it comes to actually doing it, not so much. So how do we actually accomplish this?
Yeah, I've gone back and forth on this, Greg. I think writing the Weed Agency a couple of years ago was a really good long detailed lesson on how Americans like reduced spending in theory. They like the concept. They like it in the generic form. But the moment you decide to cut actually cut spending in any particular program, all of a sudden they go, whoa, that's really important. That's bone marrow. It's not trimming the fat. And of course, you know, people who want to defend a particular program will always be strongly motivated and very loud. People who like reduced spending, you know, the support is about a mile wide and inch deep. Now, there's a certain, you know, cynical, you almost want to give cynical credit to Donald Trump when he gives purely lip service to controlling spending and says, this is all waste, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse, and we can manage it just by eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse. Well, no, not really. Foreign aid is a drop in the bucket of federal spending. Really, when you get down to it, you got to do entitlement reform and or cut defense spending. And for obvious reasons, we're not big fans of defense spending cuts because the world is full of people who want to kill us and we do need to fight back against them. You know, entitlement reform never is popular. The country, you could argue that the 2012 presidential election was a referendum on this. And America said, no, it's doing fine. You know, there's always some incumbent who will say, no, we can put off the cuts later. We can tax the rich later. It's all fine. And a majority of Americans, until the crisis comes, I think most Americans will always say, yeah, we'll deal with it later until we're fresh out of later. I don't know about you, Greg. It just makes me want to get away somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Just because the federal government is completely irresponsible at times, many times, in fact, doesn't mean you have to be with your next family vacation. Did you know that the average family visits 5 totally different websites before booking a vacation rental? You can spend less time planning your next trip and more time relaxing with Tripping.com, the world's number one site for vacation rentals.
Tripping.com is trusted by millions of travelers and featured by the New York Times, Travel and Leisure, Forbes, and more. Whether you're looking for a cabin or a beachfront home to get away to this winter, or already looking ahead to vacations this spring, Tripping.com can help you find the perfect place to stay. Vacation rentals offer flexibility, perks and amenities that you just can't find in a hotel, like multiple bedrooms, backyards, hot tubs, free Wi-Fi, and even fully stocked kitchens. So you can plan and cook your own meals, which is great for families and large groups.
And this is obviously going to be Super Bowl weekend. If you were going to go to the game, you'd probably have already made those accommodations. So you're thinking, hey, what's the big athletic event on the schedule coming up? Well, of course, it's the Final Four, the men's Final Four, San Antonio, the weekend of the very end of March and the beginning of April. And I just did a quick look at Tripping.com. If you want a hotel, you could get it a little cheaper at some of the discount hotels, but a mainstream to good hotel, you're going to probably pay north of $200, perhaps north of $300. You can get 4-bedroom, 3-bedroom houses for the same price in San Antonio, a lot more space, cook your own meals, stretch out, and you can bring more people in and divide up the cost. So it's going to be a whole lot cheaper for you. With Tripping.com, one search lets you filter, compare, and sort over 10 million available properties on trusted sites like VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and more. Don't wonder if you're getting the best deal. You'll save an average of 18% per night by booking your vacation with Tripping.com. So don't forget, if you want to save time and money while booking the perfect vacation rental for your next trip, go to tripping.com/martini today. That's TRIPPING.com/martini. Tripping.com/martini. Speaking of wanting to get away, or perhaps just tripping in general, Jim, let's talk about the latest dizzying twists and turns in the memo debate here in Washington. The much ballyhooed release the memo campaign might be coming to an end as soon as today. We'll find out. Maybe by the time some folks hear this, it'll have come out either in redacted or unredacted form. It was just over the weekend that the FBI director had a chance to head up to Capitol Hill and look at the memo. Some of the initial reports saw were that the FBI was distressed, but in the end, there was nothing factually inaccurate. Now we've got a statement from the FBI on Wednesday saying, with regard to the House Intelligence Committee's memorandum, the FBI was provided a limited opportunity to review this memo the day before the committee voted to release it. As expressed during our initial review, we have grave concerns about material omissions of fact that fundamentally impact the memo's accuracy. Nonetheless, of course, the committee released it. That's up to the president to decide what he wants to do with it. But last night, Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, tweets out, breaking, discovered late tonight that Chairman Nunes made material changes to the memo he sent to the White House, changes not approved by the committee. White House therefore reviewing a document the committee has not approved for release, at which point a Nunes staffer said, yeah, we made some changes you wanted us to make, and we agreed to, as well as some punctuation and maybe some grammar issues. So, Jim, this is getting a little bit tedious here. It certainly seems like the Democrats don't want much of it to get out. The Republicans do want it to get out. Trump might be wanting to get it out there for personal reasons. I don't know anymore. Let's just end this thing, and hopefully the more sunshine, the better.
You know, Greg, as I put it yesterday, I want them to release the memo. I want them to release the Democratic counter memo. Unless it's national security on par with the nuclear codes or the knock lists, you know, release the underlying documents. I don't see, and it's worth noting in that FBI objection, there was no mention of this will disclose sources and methods or put someone's life at risk or something like that. It was simply, no, you're omitting certain stuff. You're omitting certain context. And, you know, look, if the memo makes the FBI look bad, this is kind of what I'd expect them to say. I want them to release all of those, Greg. I want them to release the hounds. I want them to release the Kraken. You name it, I want it released, because it's turning into this endless telephone game in which people are saying, oh, you know, we look behind the curtain. You're not going to believe this memo. Democratic lawmaker looks behind the same curtain. Ah, it's nothing really all that big. Look, whatever is in the memo, either it really is this giant bombshell or it isn't, right? They basically, this is written by Nunes and his staff. If it really is that shocking, you know, I don't imagine what would be in it that would put anybody's, you know, life at risk or national security secrets or something like that. From what we're getting, it just makes the FBI leadership sound very partisan and very you wouldn't have faith in the leadership of the FBI based on what's in this thing. Okay, so let's see it. The Democrats say, oh, it's not that big a deal. Okay, let's see the Democratic counterargument. And if you're saying, well, Nunes is misinterpreting the source documents, okay, let's see the source documents. Let's, you know, I mean, unless this stuff's going to get somebody killed at this point, you know, the narrative coming out of the Trump administration and certain Republicans in Congress is the FBI had an axe to grind against Donald Trump from the beginning. They were much more interested in protecting Hillary Clinton. So they kind of dragged their feet and looked the other way and all that stuff. Look, maybe they did. All right. It's not unbelievable. The text from Strozek and all that stuff. And the arguments about McCabe, apparently the FBI's inspector general is looking at McCabe and kind of asking why was he, you know, why certain decisions took so long. All right, maybe it's true. Maybe these guys really are this bad, or maybe it's not that bad. Maybe there's a counter argument for everything they're doing. But at this point, we're playing the telephone game. We're only getting bits and pieces of all this, and it's kind of maddening to constantly be expected to react to these kind of, oh my goodness, without actually seeing the documents in question. So, you know, again, unless there's, you know, some really good pressing national security reason, let's put that stuff out there and let the American people decide for themselves.
Jim, I have a bold prediction on this. Everyone's pre-existing opinion is going to be reinforced by what comes out.
I think you're right, Greg, but there's this way. If this really is a nothing burger, you know, then Devin Nunes will come out of it. Like, you know, there are certain people I trust to say, look, you know, who argue against interest and say, you know what, this is a nothing burger. There are a couple of people I think who are not hacks who would say, no, actually, this really makes the FBI leadership look partisan and untrustworthy, that they would say so. Even if they're, you know, critics of Trump, or even if they're, you know, not fans of the administration or Republicans in general or things like that. I do believe those people exist, Greg, although I may be naive in this. They're right next to the unicorns. I believe in them.
Doesn't mean there won't be important revelations. We're just in such a polarized atmosphere that you will either say, yes, this is proof that the whole system's corrupt, or this is a Republican smear job. So it all depends on where you already stand. But we'll see. We'll see what happens here. Jim, always fun to be with you. See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Friday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch. In the meantime, visit our friends at tripping.com to book your next vacation rental. tripping.com/martini.